It's 6 p.m. Friday, so it's time for the 6 p.m. Friday news with Mr. Cannonball Adderley in the background. And I'm getting ready to get Rasan on the air. He's a local music teacher here in Los Angeles, great percussionist, grew up right here in the neighborhood where the radio station is. So let's go back to Cannonball Adderley here on the 6 p.m. news. I'm going to read a great article today on our L.A. mayor, too, Villagriosa. So again, sorry I had the music a little bit too loud. This is Hassan, 6 p.m. Kill Radio News with Cannonball Adderley in the background.
Okay, everybody, I have Rasan Keita on the air here in Akil Radio. Rasan, you there with me, brother?
I'm here, my brother, loud and clear.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum wassalam.
On this Friday before Dr. King's birthday. Okay, Rasan, I had a great conversation with you last Friday. Well, first, let me tell the audience how I introduced you. Because, you know, our station is right in the neighborhood by LACC.
Uh-huh.
I think you've been down here. And I introduced you as a music teacher, mm-hmm. a local person who grew up in this neighborhood. And tell some of the other people what you're doing around, you know, around L.A. Kind of introduce yourself. Tell them who you are.
Well, you know, I'm a long-time community activist, you know. And, you know, activism in various forms. I'm a former Black Panther Party member, as well as a Pan-Africanist. And I've also worked in a mental health area for such a long time. So, you know, the only difference is today I use culture and music is our way of continuing the struggle, you know, for people. So music and culture and art basically is what we use as our tool, our weapon of choice, you might say. And we're just trying to do some productive things in the community to make it more relevant, make the art more relevant to what the community needs are all about. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Okay, well, Rasan, one of the reasons why I wanted to call you, Let me turn this volume down. We don't have any engineer here at Kill Radio. I got to do it all myself. But one of the reasons why I wanted to call you, because we had a great conversation about this project. When we talked last week, this project you're doing, very inclusive project, but I think it'll be coming out of the Leimert Park area of Los Angeles, which is the African-American community, and I know you spent a lot of time over there. You teach a percussion class over there. Great class. I took it. But this project that you're doing, you want to involve the whole city. Could you talk a little bit about that and in some ways people could get in touch with you if they're here? I mean, our station goes all over the country, but for people right here in Los Angeles who might want to be a part of this project.
Yeah, that's very good. Thank you. Last time I was in Guinea, West Africa, I was there doing the winter season, or their rainy season, which is our summer. And so I was there, and I was able to interact with a lot of people. That we didn't get a chance to do a lot of drumming because it was wet outside. But what I did get to do is converse with a lot of people, and I talked with former members of the National Ballets. I talked with civilians, military people, students, and just people in general. And as a whole, the people meet that the best period of the high point of Guinean culture was the era of Sékou Touré. And Sékou Touré's era, you know, was started in the late 50s up into the 70s when he finally died. But what Sékou Touré succeeded in doing was uniting the culture, the entire culture of Guinea. And, you know, they had what you call a cultural revolution, but it was a bloodless cultural revolution, not like anywhere else in Africa at that time. And he did it through art, through culture, through the Ministry of Sports, Arts, and Culture. And I thought that was magnificent. It was a light bulb just that went off in my head. And I realized that the way to unite our black communities is through culture, through music, through art. He was able to pull together the various different tribal groups, some that were rivals with one another, and he was able to do it through the art, through the music. So they formed the National Ballets, and through that, the dance and the culture, they were able to unite the people under one, and it became Guinea. So I got that idea about us here in our community. You know, most of your artists that I associate with are former revolutionaries, former members of various organizations who were involved in the community at one point in time. And yet, you know, we turned to the arts because that was the one common denominator. But we didn't have anything that was uniting us. So we needed some type of organization. So the organization that I came up with, modeled after the one in Guinea, is a Pan-African Cultural Arts Federation. The Pan-African Cultural Arts Federation is similar to the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s, except it's international in scope. The Black Arts Movement that was here in the 60s and the early 70s was just national, but this is international. So we're dealing with all the various cultures of the diaspora.
Okay, well, Rasan, let me ask you this, because again, I don't want to keep you too long, because I know you got your baby girl there, and she's like still a baby, and you got to watch her. But we could do this through the marvels of telephone. I was a little scared for a minute, you guys, because Rasan thought it was going to be an in-studio interview, and I really wanted to get him on today, so I'm glad it was a phone interview. But let me toot your horn for you a little bit, Rasan, for the people, who aren't familiar with you. Rasan is a master teacher here in Los Angeles, a percussion teacher. And his son, Khalil, who's going up to Cal Arts right now, everybody, you guys are going to hear about Khalil in a couple years. I think he's one of the toughest young percussionists in the city of Los Angeles right now. And he is, going into his second year up at Cal Arts?
Right.
So Rasan and Khalil are teaching classes. I know Khalil helps you out in the summer. And is Khalil going to be a part of this? Is he going to have time to be involved in this project too?
Oh, yeah, because we're involving all the different genres, you know, Afro-Cuban, Afro-Brazilian, you know, Haitian, you know, Native American, you know, it's all drumming. And one thing, good thing about it is that CalArts, you come to contact with all those different cultural groups. So he's definitely involved in it, and we're definitely looking toward to get the young people all involved in it.
And Rahsaan, again, this, I mean, like you said, I mean, I want to be a part of this. I think this is going to do a lot of things in the city. I mean, and this is open to the whole city. Our Latino brothers, our Asian brothers, I mean, everybody is involved. You want everybody involved in this, don't you?
That's why we're using the arts. We're using the arts. You know, anybody who's an artist, whether you're a painter, you know, writer, poet, musician, you know, and your main focus is to just use the art to help, you know, transform the communities, you know, to get them, to lift them out, you know, of the cloud and the disparity, and give them some hope.
In the
teaching
cool
classes, yeah, teaching classes, you know, giving kids skills, you know, that they can learn, that they can take with them, teaching them how to not only play the music, but how to write the music, how to make drums, how to prepare drums, you know, the whole thing, you know. This really gives them some skills and something that they can do in the future.
And Rahsaan, with this new mayor we have right now, who actually grew up in a pretty rough area of the city and loves this city, I mean, I think something like this might get off the ground. I know he's put together a cultural board who's going to be looking to work on projects like this. Listen, just let me ask you one or two quick questions, and then I'm going to let you go, Rahsaan. If people want to get in touch with you, I know you don't like giving your cell phone number out on the radio, but people can contact you through my show here at Kill Radio. I do the 6 p.m. news every Friday, and I do my jazz show on Monday nights, straight ahead on Monday nights and 6 p.m. here at Kill Radio. You can email me, and I'll get you in touch with Rahsaan. Is that the best way?
Well, that's one way. Another way is contact me through my personal email. We have a website.
Oh, give all that information, man.
Okay. Our website is www.balandukukan.
Okay, now you got to go real slow. You got to go real slow again.
Okay. Okay, it's www.balandugukan. Now, Balandugukan is spelled Balandugukan, K-A-N. So that's www.balandugukan.com.
Okay.
And my email is balandugukan@yahoo.com.
Okay.
Balandugukan@yahoo.com.
And for anybody who didn't get all that, you could, like I said, you can reach me here at 6 p.m. Friday News, Kill Radio. I'm Rahsaan. I can get you in touch with Rahsaan. One more quick question, Rahsaan. We were talking about on the phone about, because you grew up here in Los Angeles. You know the whole city. I did not. And we were talking about Tookie Williams' execution last month. And actually, they're getting ready to execute another cat this Monday. They're going to execute another person here in the state of California. And we were talking about how Arnold Schwarzenegger, our illustrious governor, had the audacity to say that he executed Tookie Williams because Tookie Williams looked up to people like George Jackson. And Rahsaan, I know you were in the Black Panthers when you were like in your late teens. And how do you feel about Schwarzenegger making a statement like that? You know, he executed Tookie Williams. I know we were talking about this.
That's totally absurd. That's totally absurd because George Jackson is known all over the world as a fighter for the people. He was a complete, total revolutionary. And he was assassinated inside a prison because of the influence he had, not inside, but outside of the prisons, all over the world, people who read his books and who understood what he stood for and what he was all about. Those people were being influenced by his books and by him, and they couldn't allow for that to stay alive. So they found a way to assassinate him. So in no way, shape, or form can you compare that to Tookie Williams.
I know, and like I was saying, if George Jackson's family wanted to, Rahsaan, they could sue the state of California because George Jackson was murdered by prison guards at Soledad. He was murdered. So, like I said, if Schwarzenegger wasn't so busy groping women and smoking pot back then, he would have known that George Jackson was murdered. You know, he's a great writer. He went into jail as a criminal, turned his life around. Like I said, I get too emotional when I talk about it. But, Rahsaan, listen, I'm going to let you go. I opened up the show with your alumni from Florida A&M, Cannonball Adderley.
All right.
We're going to go back into Cannonball right now, and I'm going to make you a copy of this interview.
Okay.
And, again, what's your emails? One more time, really slow.
Okay. The email is baladugukan@yahoo.com.
One more time, really slow.
baladugukan@yahoo.com.
Okay, Rahsaan, salamu alaikum. I'll see you, bro.
Alaikum salam, my brother. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, peace.
And again, that was an interview with Rahsaan Keita, who lives just up the street from the radio station here, who's involved in the arts here in Los Angeles. And let's go back into Cannonball Adderley, the great Cannonball Adderley.
Oh, hello, everybody again. This is Hassan on the 6 p.m. news with Mr. Cannonball Adderley in the background on that beautiful alto saxophone. Cannonball died about 20 years ago, but boy, could he play that saxophone. And this is the kind of music you'll hear on my jazz show on Monday nights. I mean, I love Miles Davis and Coltrane, but you know... You'll hear some of that, but you'll hear a lot of people who weren't that famous, like Cannonball Adderley, who you hear right now in the background. So tune into my jazz show every Monday night at midnight until the wee hours. So right now on the 6 p.m. news here, I want to read an article. I was actually wondering, you guys, what I was going to do today. I knew I was going to have that interview with my brother Rasan, but I also wondered what else was I going to do. And then I read this article in the Hollywood Independent newspaper here in Los Angeles as I was having lunch today at one of my favorite Japanese eateries in the neighborhood. And I was reading this article. I love Japanese food. Anyway, and, you know, we just have a new mayor out here who I voted for because I like him. Mayor Villagriosa, Antonio Villagriosa. And I'm going to read this article that was written by Mr. Art Mayor Grokel. I'm sorry, sir, if I pronounced your name wrong. Who wrote this article? It's on the front page of the Today's Hollywood Independent, and it's called "I'm Taking Over Our Schools." Mayor Villagriosa tells Superintendent Romer, "I'm taking over our schools." Okay, and let's see. Education: Mayor sets timetable for taking control of LA's troubled school system by Art Mar Aqui, special to the Independent. Mayor Antonio Villagriosa has told Los Angeles School Superintendent Roy Romer that he intends to take control of the nation's second largest school district before the end of his first term. Go ahead, Antonio. Villagriosa said he made the comments during a 90-minute meeting between the two men at City Hall last week. Quote, unquote, "I made it absolutely clear that I will not be deterred on this issue of mayoral." I can never pronounce that word right. "A mayoral responsibility and accountability for our schools on empowering parents and teachers and ensuring we have more accountability," quote unquote, Villagriosa said. Romer said the meeting was not intended to be a political discussion on governance. We wanted to share what we're doing in the district. District governance has been a contentious issue since last spring when Villagriosa made a campaign, continued on page 4. Wait a minute. Okay. Promised to wrestle control of LAUSD from the school board. Villagriosa has said he believes that one person should be held accountable for the district's performance, citing low test scores and high dropout rates in LAUSD. Villagriosa and Romer said they agreed to find ways to accurately measure LAUSD student dropout rates. Thank God, it's about time someone did. Romer maintains that the student dropout rate is 24.6% compared with a 33.1% determined by the state during the 203-04 school year. Villagriosa, meanwhile, says he favors figures released last March by Harvard University's Civil Rights Project, which shows that more than half of LAUSD's students failed to finish high school. The mayor wants to have accurate information on the dropout rate. Romer said, "We talked about how we can get that information, have it verified, so he can rely on it, and we can rely on it," quote unquote. Villagriosa said that if Romer found an accurate way to count dropouts, then he would stand by the findings. The men agreed that the city should assist in the school district's push to provide more programs and build more facilities. Villagriosa said the city should pay 20% of cost, while the school district should foot 80% of the bill. Quote unquote, "We need to build schools," quote unquote, Villagriosa said. "We talked about using city council members as support for that." Villagriosa and Romer said they avoided discussing city controller Laura Chick's bid to conduct an $800,000 audit of the school district. Villagriosa and the city council support the audit, while Romer opposes the idea because he says the LAUSD has already undergone a series of audits that have helped boost the district's bond ratings. Quote unquote, my only purpose here is to help children learn better. And I do not want audits used for political purposes, quote unquote, Romer said. Excuse me. Villagriosa said that before talks last week, both men had, quote unquote, agreed early on in the controversy to disagree. Oh, excuse me, I have a little gas, I guess, from that Japanese meal. Anyway, Romer said the meeting with Villagriosa was a chance for him to discuss the school district's progress over the last 5 years and to outline goals they can meet together. He denied speculation that the school district and the mayor's office had lost communication amid calls for an audit and Villagriosa's desire to control LAUSD. This is not a public relations move, Romer said. When you're as large an operation as we are, from time to time, you need to sit down with the people who run the city to show what we're doing, and how we can accomplish things together. End of article. And again, that was a great article by Art Marquol. He's a regular reporter with City News Service, and that was in today's Hollywood Independent, or this week's Hollywood Independent, Thursday, January 12th, 2006. And again, if you guys want to hear this show again, we upload everything to Radio for All here at Kill Radio, and I'll be doing that in a couple of days. RadioForAll.net, Radio4All.net. And it'll be if I can get my technical skills together, it'll also be posted on the homepage here of the Kill Radio website, the homepage. And again, I'm Hassan, and let's put Cannonball Adderley back on, because we're going to go into a speech by Dr. King. A great, great speech, you guys. This speech actually brings tears to my eyes. And this is a speech I never heard. I never heard this speech until within the next... I never heard this speech until I came here to Kill Radio, so I thank these people for turning me on to it. The IMC, our network here. It's the famous speech that Dr. King did at the Riverside Church in Harlem in the middle 60s, when a lot of people think this is the speech that got him killed, because he talks about stopping Vietnam, pulling out of Vietnam. See, I guess it was all right for him to talk about freeing black people and all that stuff, but when it came to messing with like arms makers and pulling out of Vietnam, that was when he had to go. And, yeah. And listen to this beautiful, beautiful flute in the background. This is a beautiful speech by Dr. King. And I'm going to, let's go back into Cannonball Adderley here on the 6 p.m. Kill Radio News. And then we're going to segue into this great speech by Dr. King, with his birthday coming up this Monday. Happy birthday, Dr. King. I got to get my glasses on here. I'm Hassan. This is the Kill Radio 6 p.m. News, Friday.
Dr. King spoke of the forces and motivations behind the conflict in the Middle East. I'm Matt Olson.
And I'm Casey Calloway. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California. In revolution, those
kids are Today is a national holiday commemorating the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. There will be marches and rallies across the country, one of the largest of which is in Los Angeles. And the storyline behind most of them is that Dr. King was a... While Dr. King was speaking about Vietnam, his words still resonate today. He could just as easily be talking about globalization and the war on terrorism. What follows is an excerpt of that speech, courtesy of the KPFK archive.
For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. And as I ponder the madness of Vietnam, and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak now not of the soldiers of each side, not of the ideologies of the Liberation Front, not of the hunter inside gone, but simply of the people who have been living under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution there until some attempt is made to know them and hear their broken cries. They must see Americans as strange liberators. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of a former colony. Our government felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence, and we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination, and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For the peasants, this new government meant real land reform, one of the most important needs in their lives. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war cost. Even before the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they began to despair of their reckless action, but we did not. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost the will. Soon we would be paying almost the full cost of this tragic attempt at recolonization. After the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come again through the Geneva Agreement. But instead there came the United States, determined that Ho should not unify the temporarily divided nation. And the peasants watched again as we supported one of the most vicious modern dictators, our chosen man, Premier Diem. The peasants watched and cringed as Diem ruthlessly rooted out all opposition, supported bad extortionist landlords, and refused even to discuss reunification with the North. The peasants watched as all this was presided over by United States influence, and then by increasing numbers of United States troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods had aroused. When Diem was overthrown, they may have been happy, but the long line of military dictators seemed to offer no real change, especially in terms of their need for land and peace. The only change came from America, as we increased our troop commitments in support of governments which were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support. All the while, the people read our leaflets and received irregular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They moved sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. They know they must move on or be destroyed by our bombs. So they go, primarily women and children and the aged. They watch as we poison their water, as we kill 1 million acres of their crops. They must weep as the bulldozers roll through their areas preparing to destroy the precious trees. They wander into the hospitals with at least 20 casualties from American firepower for one Viet Cong inflicted injury. So far we may have killed 1 million of them, mostly children. They wander into the towns and see thousands of the children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do the peasants think as we ally ourselves with the landlords and as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform? What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? Where are the roots of the independent Vietnam we claim to be building? Is it among these voiceless ones? We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have cooperated in the crushing of the nation's only non-communist revolutionary political force, the Unified Buddhist Church. We have supported the enemies of the peasants of Saigon. We have corrupted their women and children and killed their men. Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. What of the National Liberation Front? That strangely anonymous group we call VC or Communists. What must they think of the United States of America? And they realize that we permitted the repression and cruelty of DM, which helped to bring them into being as a resistance group in the South. What do they think of our condoning the violence, which led to their own taking up of arms? How can they believe in our integrity when now we speak of aggression from the North, as if there were nothing more essential to the war? How can they trust us, for now we charge them with violence after the murderous reign of Diem, and charge them with violence while we pour every new weapon of death into their land? Surely we must understand their feelings, even if we do not condone their actions. Surely we must see that the men we supported pressed them to their violence. Surely we must see that our own computerized plans of destruction simply dwarf their greatest acts. How do they judge us when our officials know that their membership is less than 25% communist and yet insist on giving them the blanket name? What must they be thinking when they know that we are aware of their control of major sections of Vietnam and yet we appear ready to allow national elections in which this highly organized political parallel government will not have a part? They ask how we can speak of free elections when the Saigon press is censored and controlled by the military junta. And they're surely right to wonder what kind of new government we plan to help form without them, the only party in real touch with the peasants. They question our political goals and they deny the reality of a peace settlement from which they will be excluded. Their questions are frighteningly relevant. Is our nation planning to build on political myth again and then shore it up upon the power of new violence? Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow in profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence, when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. So too with Hanoi, in the north where our bombs now pummel the land, and our mines endanger the waterways, we are met by a deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. In Hanoi are the men who led the nation to independence against the Japanese and the French, the men who sought membership in the French Commonwealth and were betrayed by the weakness of Paris and the willfulness of the colonial armies. After 1954, they watched us conspire with Diem to prevent elections which could have surely brought Ho Chi Minh to power over a united Vietnam. And they realized they had been betrayed again. When we ask why they do not leap to negotiate, these things must be remembered. Also, it must be clear that the leaders of Hanoi considered the presence of American troops in support of the Diem regime to have been the initial military breach of the Geneva agreements concerning foreign troops. And they remind us that they did not begin to send troops in large numbers and even supplies into the South until American forces had moved into the tens of thousands. And now I remember how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures for peace, how the president claimed that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces. And now he has surely heard the increasing international rumors of American plans for an invasion of the North. Perhaps only his sense of humor and of irony can save him when he hears the most powerful nation of the world speaking of aggression as it drops thousands of bombs on a poor, weak nation more than 8,000 miles away from its shores. At this point, I should make it clear that while I have tried in these last few minutes to give a voice to the voiceless in Vietnam, to understand the arguments of those who are called enemy, I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. For it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. Before long, they must know that their government has sent them into a struggle among Vietnamese. And the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. This is the message of the great Buddhist leaders of Vietnam. Recently, one of them wrote these words, and I quote, "Each day the war goes on, the hatred increases in the heart of the Vietnamese and in the hearts of those of humanitarian instinct. The Americans are forcing even their friends into becoming their enemies. It is curious that the Americans, who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory, do not realize that in the process they are incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism," unquote. If we continue, there will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam. If we do not stop our war against the people of Vietnam immediately, the world will be left with no other alternative than to see this as some horrible, clumsy, and deadly game we have decided to play. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. It demands that we admit that we have been wrong from the beginning of our adventure in Vietnam, that we have been detrimental to the life of the Vietnamese people. The situation is one in which we must be ready to turn sharply from our present ways in order to atone for our sins and errors in Vietnam. We should take the initiative in bringing a halt to this tragic war and set a date that we will remove all foreign troops from Vietnam in accordance with the 1954 Geneva Agreement. Part of our ongoing... Part of our ongoing commitment might well express itself in an offer to grant asylum to any Vietnamese who fears for his life under the new regime, which included the Liberation Front. Then we must make what reparations we can for the damage we have done. We must provide the medical aid that is badly needed, making it available in this country if necessary. Meanwhile, we in the churches and synagogues have a continuing task while we urge our government to disengage itself from a disgraceful commitment. We must continue to raise our voices and our lives if our nation persists in its perverse ways in Vietnam. We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible. These are the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions. But we must all protest. Now that is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit, and if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. also such thoughts take us beyond Vietnam, but not beyond our calling as sons of the living God. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution. During the past 10 years, we have seen emerge a pattern of suppression, which has now justified the presence of U.S. military advisors in Venezuela. This need to maintain social stability for our investments accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, and why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. It is with such activity in mind that the words of the late John F. Kennedy come back to haunt us. 5 years ago, he said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. True revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
That was an excerpt from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Beyond Vietnam speech, delivered on April 4, 1967, at a meeting of clergy and laity concerned at Riverside Church in New York City.
Dr. Vincent Harding, longtime colleague and friend of Dr. King, and author of the Beyond Vietnam speech you just heard, has been an activist for over 40 years. From his early work in the Southern Freedom Movement to his time as director for the Martin Luther King Jr.
And so I came to see him and listen for a while. And there he was, this young boy, stranger to my eyes, strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words. But he just kept right on strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly.
Okay, everybody, as we go back to Mr. Cannonball Adderley in the background, and we just got finished listening to the old Roberta Flack standard, had me singing here in the studio, Killing Me Softly. I don't think that was Roberta singing that. That woman sounded a lot younger. If you know who it was, call me and tell me. But I loved it anyway. And before that, we were listening to that great speech that Dr. King did in the early 60s in Harlem at the famous Riverside Church in Harlem. And again, a lot of people think that might have been one of the speeches that was responsible for his murder, because he was coming out against the war. And rich people make a lot of money in war. And I couldn't help but think of the parallels, the things he was saying about the soldiers being wounded compared to this war now. And we all know that Bush's father was very active back then, too. He was very active, you know, as a young lawyer working for Nixon. You know, he's not all that innocent. He knows where the bodies are buried. Maybe even as far back as Kennedy. This is the old elder Bush. But anyway, this is the end of the 6 p.m. Friday news. I don't think Xenophone's going to come in tonight, so I'm just going to go a few minutes longer. And then we're going to put on some old Xenophone tapes. I think I might hear him coming in now. This is Hassan. This is the Kill Radio 6 p.m. news, Friday. And I just wanted to make some small comments about what's going on in the world right now. The thing taking up all the media attention is this nomination for this Supreme Court Justice, Alito. It's been all over the news. And I just want to say one thing about that. Believe me, he will be nominated because Bush wants him to be nominated. Believe me, everybody, if Clarence Thomas can get nominated to the Supreme Court, Popeye the Sailor can be nominated. Okay? If Clarence Thomas can be nominated, anybody can be nominated, okay? Clarence Thomas took Thurgood Marshall's place. Clarence Thomas couldn't carry Thurgood Marshall's dirty underwear. Thurgood Marshall was a hero to a lot of people in this country, to myself, to a lot of people. And when Bush Sr. put Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, it was an insult to African Americans, to poor people all over the world. There was a joke that said if Bush Sr. couldn't have found a Clarence Thomas, he would have been Vanity. So Alito will be nominated. There's nothing we can do about it. Roe v. Wade will probably be turned over. Earlier, I think yesterday, they showed a picture of Alito's wife sitting behind him at the Senate hearings, and she was crying. And an interesting comment was made on Air America. I think Randy Rose said it, how, well, we do feel sorry. She was crying because some Democratic senators were saying some disparaging words about her husband. And just like Randy Rhodes said on Air America, well, a lot of women are going to be crying all across this country if Roe v. Wade is overturned. So anyway, I'm rambling. So this is the 6 p.m. Kill Radio News. And we're going to go back into Cannonball Adderley. And then we're going to go into Rasan, who we heard earlier. We're going to hear his music, some music that him and his son have made. They have a band called Drums of Passion here in Los Angeles. And again, if you want to get in touch with Rasan, if you didn't get all his email info, you can email me, Hassan at HassanJ53@yahoo.com. Okay, if you didn't get all that info on Rasan, if you want to study with him, he's a great percussion teacher on the African drums, African djembes. You can email me at Hassan, there's two S's, HassanJ53@yahoo.com. And again, listen to my show on Monday nights, Straight Ahead Jazz. And let's go back into Cannonball Adderley. And then we're going to go into Rasan's group, Drums of Passion. And thanks for listening, you guys. I love you all. And have a happy Dr. King Day this upcoming Monday. Okay, this is Kill Radio, 6 p.m. Friday News. Remember, it just might save your life.